So, also,
the green bowl there is for donations to Kusala Yoga as to help keep Dharmapuns here. I don't take money for teaching, so your donations just go to keep us in the space. I do know that rents are very expensive, even here in charming Greenpoint. So if you can, give generally between $3 and $5 to sustain. So if you can't do that, don't worry about it. Even if you can't give anything, don't worry about it at all. But if you can give, it would be I'll certainly be grateful because it helps keep us in this space and helps subsidize Kusala Yoga, which is a good organization. So, okay. I thought tonight I'd talk about what mindfulness is, which is a very core concept in Buddhist practice. When the kind of Buddhism that I practice is generally known or often referred to as the Theravada, which separates it or distinguishes it from Zen and Tibetan. The Theravada in practice is Southeast Asia. When it was popularized in the West, though, it was popularized under, especially in America, under the name Vipassana, which means insight. And Vipassana is not really a word that was used that often by the Buddha in the Pali Canon, but being synonymous with insight, one of the things that the early popularizers like Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg and Joseph Goldstein did is they focused on teaching just a couple of core concepts. And the one that they really focused on was mindfulness, which was the Buddha talked about at length in a sutta called the Satipatthana, which means the four foundations of where to focus the mind or where to rest the mind. So because they tended to focus on just that, they would really draw out mindfulness into a long series of evenings. And so it became quite commonplace to teach mindfulness over many, 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 you know, meetings and classes and really stretch it out. And I suppose there are some advantages for that because you can get very detailed, but the disadvantages of it is that the Buddha never taught it over a lot of different classes. He actually taught it in one sitting. And I think it's worthwhile teaching it, making it really portable, making mindfulness very easy to carry around, because it really shouldn't be something that requires a lot of thinking to use it as a tool to bring peace and to bring insight into how we cause ourselves stress and suffering. So tonight I'm just going to give an overview of what the Buddha's teaching on mindfulness is and how it's useful, and try to just cover the four foundations in and of themselves so that you can use it as a way to bring the insight into your own minds and your own practice. So the Buddha starts out by saying that it's clear that mindfulness is something that can be unlike samadhi, which is practiced or concentration or meditation, which is generally done, you know, either like we're doing tonight in a group that in a special area where the mind is focused, or in a with our eyes closed. Mindfulness can be done anytime. It can be done in our lives, where we work, where we're exercising. It can be done all throughout life. And unlike the meditation, which really is done in, you could meditate for a couple of hours, but it's not something that most people would try to do for sustained, complete, concentrated inwards awareness for 18 hours a day. You can actually do mindfulness every hour we're awake. it's something that can be done as part of a practice of in our lives. And generally, when we're on retreat, if we go on a retreat, mindfulness is established throughout. And I'll talk about how it works. There's three components to being mindful. The first is what's known as sati, which means simply standing back enough from whatever we're focusing on the mind on, to know if we are aware of what's going on inside, and to follow a certain order of awareness. The order of awareness, as the Buddha said again and again and again, mindfulness is based on first becoming aware of the breath and the body, how your body feels. The second is to become aware of what our gut feelings are, how the body is expressing emotions. The third is to know what mood we're in. And the fourth is to know whether our thoughts are skillful or not skillful. So it's first breath, second feelings, third moods, and fourth thoughts. And the reason why the Buddha always had us go into the body first is because most of us experience our thoughts as very compelling, very sticky, very, 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 very hard to separate from. And if we first try to establish mindfulness of just what our thoughts are, we're not going to succeed. We're going to stick inside them, identify with them, and be carried away by our thoughts to wherever they want to carry us. Sometimes we could be in a very important conversation and we're totally unaware because our thoughts have carried us to a reflection or a fear or a projection or something that we're concerned about. Do I have enough money to pay the rent or whatever? And so we're totally unaware of what we're doing. So the way we reestablish awareness and mindfulness is by always first going to the breath, feel how the breath feels, how the body feels, then the feelings, then the moods, and then the thoughts. And I'm going to talk about each. So the first is just standing back and just know where the mind is and bring it back to that cycle of awareness. The second is to have what's known as sampujjana, which means bare attention. It means, generally when we're focusing on something like a sound or a conversation with somebody or something at work, we're adding a lot of thinking to it. We're commenting on it in our mind. Oh, I wish that great sound of the, you know, that was going on during the meditation, I wish that would stop, or I wish that this person next to me wasn't doing this or that, or I wish that I didn't feel hot or whatever. So we're not only are we experiencing awareness of something, but then we're adding all this thinking and all this resistance towards it. And the Buddha was pretty much calling for a kind of attention that's not adding commentary, that's just aware, fully aware, without adding all that underlying sort of, you know, when you're watching a movie and there's a voiceover. So we're trying to let go of the voiceover so that we see the movie, but there's none of the, you know, the voiceover that we add in our minds beneath every experience in life. So it's just of trying to have a kind of quiet, completely as little judgment as we can, and just as much of a kind of agendaless awareness. And then the third is apamada, or which means effort. It takes a lot of effort to be mindful, because the mind will again and again and again want to climb into thoughts and completely slip away, or will want to completely get sucked into something external and completely lose all awareness of what's going on inside. So the effort of mindfulness is again and again to rebalance the mind so that we're not being completely sucked away, whether by a thought or by an external drama. Maybe you're watching something on TV and it's really wonderful and it's like, oh, I love Breaking Bad, it's such a great show, how wonderful it is, I'm watching it right now, I'm so wrapped up, I have no awareness of the fact that my breath has become really shallow, that my body has become tense with every, you know, dramatic situation, that I'm not aware of the mood of worry, maybe, or whatever mood has arisen in the mind. I'm not aware of all the kinds of thinking that are going on. So we are again and again and again with mindfulness rebalancing the mind. You can still be aware of what's going on around you. I can be mindful at a job, or the Buddha said we can be mindful while, he gives a whole long list which goes from everything from eating and walking to shitting and urinating to talking. So you can be mindful during anything, so long as you've got part of the mind aware of what's going on, again, first in the breath and in the body, second in the gut feelings, third in the mood, and fourth, then standing outside of the thoughts, looking at them and knowing if they're skillful or not. So the first is being aware of the breath, just like we were during the meditation. But we can be aware of the breath even when we're not meditating. You can, if we're having a panic attack, the first thing we do, for example, is go and ask ourselves, can I make the breath slower and deeper? Because when we're having a panic attack or worry, we are having quick, shallow breath. So, I was like, he's taping somebody to a lamppost for a torture session.
Wire.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. Hopefully they're promoting something worthwhile. There's a lot of value to being aware of what's going on in the breath and the body. When we were driving back from the retreat, Kathy became aware of just how much physical tightness goes into driving. When I got back, I was noticing just being on Facebook. Again, whenever time I've noticed just like the amount, because you think a lot of actions in life are very benign and don't require any effort. But actually, just bringing body awareness into all the different endeavors of life, it's incredible to notice just how much effort goes into everything. It builds up not only appreciation of the body and all it does to support everything that we're doing, but it also does some really important things. It brings us awareness of how often we're completely unaware of what we're doing, of what's going on right here and right now. If you've ever hung out with monks, and I've hung out with a lot of monks over the years, I've never seen a monk trip, stumble, drop anything, do anything even remotely graceless. They're the most graceful human beings. They move like dancers. And they almost like float. They don't make that sound, but I'm making sound. Like they're on some kind of like science fiction hovercraft. You walk behind Ajahn Sucito, it's like, and I become aware of just, oh my God, how clunky and loud my movements are. And not only is there this incredible gratitude I get for being alive and having a human body, but this inner awareness begins to reduce the amount of stress that goes into every moment of my life, because I'm just focusing on the thing I'm doing rather than allowing the mind to drift off. And the more the mind is trying to do three things at the same time, worry about money, worry about, you know, something that somebody said to me or whatever, worrying about, you know, also something else, then I'm not going to be focusing and bringing the amount of attention to what I'm doing that will make it something that can bring peace. A lot of things that I drift away from, like waiting for a subway or things that we don't like doing, it could be, you know, flossing, I don't know, whatever you don't like doing. If I bring awareness to it and feel the sensations, I can actually make something that I generally experience as difficult or challenging, I can actually experience I can transform my relationship with it. You can be constantly amazed when you're on a retreat doing walking meditation, just feeling the left, then the right foot, then the left foot, then the right foot. It can be really amazing, just the process of walking, and you can really sound like a real idiot. You go to your friend later, wow, walking. It's fucking amazing. You know? But we generally don't carry any of this inner awareness of the stress, the amount of effort that goes into life, and how we can make the body and the breath as comfortable so that when we're doing something that we bring normally a lot of unnecessary resistance into, we can relax it. Which brings us to the second part, which is awareness of feelings, which the Buddha called Vedana. Feelings are not the necessary muscle contractions and breathing that goes to support movement. Feelings are emotions in the body that help us make decisions. You've known feelings in your life when you feel suddenly the stomach tensing, when we get bad news or something that causes a stress, or the jaw locking. Maybe we notice our jaw moving or locking. Maybe we notice the shoulders getting tight. But these are known in psychology and in neuroscience as somatic markers, which simply are a part of the brain's way of letting us know that in the past we've experienced this same situation as worrisome or difficult. For example, one time in our life we might experience being in a test as very, very traumatic. We go to a test, we do badly, and then when somebody else later on in life says, okay, there'll be a test, suddenly the shoulder goes up like this, or the stomach gets really tight, or the jaw locks, or our brow gets really tight. This is an emotional underlying response to say, I don't like this. I haven't liked this in the past. It's your unconscious through the limbic system, through the amygdala, letting you know that sometime in your life you've experienced something as unwanted, disagreeable. On the other hand, there are times when the unconscious will relax the body and bring ease because you've gotten good news or something that in the past you've experienced as easeful and relaxing has reoccurred. For example, the sound of coming home at night after a hard day of work and locking the door and sitting down might suddenly, you might react to that by relaxing the shoulders, relaxing the stomach. So unconsciously, you're saying, ah, this is good. So constantly throughout the day, we're marking our experiences as, oh, this is going to be shitty, I don't like this, or, ooh, this is going to be really good, I can relax and let go. Ooh, I don't like this person, I better stay guarded and get defensive. Ooh, I like this person, I can relax. I don't need to be guarded. I can let my shoulders down. I can let my chest relax. So there's this underlying Vedana or feelings that are constantly going on in the body. And part of the practice is just to become aware of how our body or how our unconscious is speaking to us through our bodies. Sometimes it's very useful. The great neuroscientist Antonio Damasio established that card players use it to figure out well before they're consciously aware. They use it to unconsciously figure out when a card is not likely to be a good card and when it's likely to be a good or bad card. Because unconsciously we become aware of things. Or if you're, for example, if you're in a situation where your unconscious is picked up that somebody is really unstable, you might not understand, you know, rationally why you're getting tense, but you'll have noticed something and the body will start getting tense. It's telling you, oh, I've been in this situation before and it wasn't good, watch out. Unfortunately, while Vedana or feelings is very important to help us make decisions, because without it we just constantly argue back and forth in our heads. For example, if you're in a restaurant and somebody asks you, what do you want to eat tonight? Would you like the hamburger or would you like the hot dog? I don't eat either, but would you like the hamburger or the hot dog? We're at Burger Guru. Would you like a hamburger or a hot dog? And you're like, what would I like? If you go back and forth in your head, well, the hamburger has so much protein, but the hot dog has so much saturated fat, but then I like the taste of the hamburger, but then I like the taste of hot dogs too. Hamburger is a little less, then you'll never stop. But if you just go with what your gut tells you, it feels a little ease when somebody says, you look at the word hamburger, there's an ease. When you look at hot dog, there's a So that's what you decide. You're constantly using Vedana or gut feelings to make decisions. And Damasio established that people who have the part of the brain that notices how the body's reacting, when that part of the brain is removed due to tumor, they can no longer make decisions. They just go back and forth and back and forth, debating in their heads what they should do, and they never can come to a final decision. So it's useful, but then sometimes in life, we incorrectly associate something's bad, and for that, the rest of our lives, whenever we re-experience that, we'll be adverse to it. This is what leads people to be shut-ins. They go outdoors one day, they experience something horrific, maybe a mugging, and their mind associates being outdoors with violence or being at risk. Perhaps we're driving in a car and we're listening to, name a group, any group. Pixies, very good. Pixies, I caught you off guard, that's good. I like that, because I generally don't do audience participation. People are always talking, what? It's not the question and answer and the sharing portion yet. Pixies, very good. So you're listening to Monkey's Gone to Heaven, and you have a car accident. The next time you hear this Monkey's Gone to Heaven, you're going to have a stress response in the body. The body's going to say, Pixies, bad accident. Of course, the Pixies didn't cause your car accident. They had nothing to do with it. The poor Pixies are now blamed by you. And every time you hear the Pixies, you get that amygdala stress response in the body. And the reason why it's helpful to be aware of what's going on in your feelings is that when we're avoiding something that's not good to avoid, whether it's taxes or going to the, dealing with a conversation that's troublesome or, looking for a job or whatever it is that we don't like doing, and then we get stressed out against it because we associate it with trauma or discomfort, we can then relax. Wherever our bodies get tight and say, I don't like this, we can relax that area. In my case, it's my stomach and my shoulders and my jaw. I might as well name half of my body, but mostly it's my stomach gets tight when I'm in fear. My brow gets really tight when I'm trying to figure out something. My jaw gets really tight when I'm angry. So I can really get a lot of insight into what's going on and how I'm making my decisions. And I'm less pushed around by my unconscious, which doesn't say I don't take my unconscious into consideration. It's just that when I'm making decisions, I can be aware of how I'm making them. And then I can also be aware of when gut feelings are good to make a decision with and when they're not so good. I'll give you an example. A gut feeling is really good to use when you're at a job. If you're like an interior designer and somebody says, would this room be good in yellow or would this room be good in green? Right? Hopefully you'd say neither, but if you're going to try to reason out everything that you've already through practice and experience worked through in your job, every single time how to rationalize it and go through all the logic behind it, you're not going to be very good. It's going to take forever to make simple decisions. Most of us, after we've been in a job for a while, we rely on our gut feelings. If you ask an interior designer or a tennis pro or whatever, somebody who's at their job, well, why did you make that decision? They won't be able to answer. They'll just say, I just knew. Through experience, I know that this is where this piece of furniture should go. This wall should be painted that color. Because they're just listening to their body. They're listening, and that's a good use of Vedana. On the other hand, in life, there are times when we let our gut push us around, often through things we're avoiding. It could be situations in life. For example, some people get fear of going in subways, and they can't go in a subway or go in an elevator because once in their life they felt a little, you know, worried in it, and then they've associated elevator or subway with fear and discomfort. And the only way to go through and to allow ourselves to do things that are important that we've avoided is by bringing awareness to how the body's speaking to us and breathing into it, relaxing it, and then we can do things that we've been avoiding for all of our lives. So much, though, of the difficulty in life is caused by physical stress. The third is thing to be aware of then is the mood, what mood we're in. It's really that simple. People make this very difficult. Mood is simply not a specific thought. It's simply what kind of mind we're in. You can see when somebody's in a bad mood because not only are they saying a lot of angry or downcast things, but their entire demeanor is really downcast, not only physically, but the entire mind is just sluggish. When you're in a bad mood, your mind just feels weighty. If we're depressed, the mind just feels completely overwhelmed and just there's no energy in it. If we're worried, the mind is just energized and throwing thought after thought after thought. It's a little bit like if a thought is a specific cloud, the mood is the overall sky, what weather we're having. If the weather is very cloudy, there'll be a lot of clouds. If the weather is clear or windy, there'll be a few clouds moving through. So whatever mood, emotional mood we're in, we become aware of. And we can notice it by sometimes when we're angry, there's just all this sense of energy in the mind, and the mind shrinks down around the person that we're angry with or the situation we're angry with. We're unaware of anything else, and we're constantly repeating the story of why we're furious with this person. It's important to know what mood we're in because, A, so often in life we do things that we regret, not realizing, oh, I'm in a really shitty mood. Before I pick up this phone and talk to this relative, this person who's been bothering me, whatever, maybe I should acknowledge I'm in a fucking sour mood and not pick up the phone. Or if I do pick up the phone, at least acknowledge to myself that I better not, at this point, use this as the opportunity to tell the person why I think they're so unskillful. Because I'll already set the foundations for I'm already in aversion. I'm probably going to bring a lot more aversion into what I'm saying than as need be. So when we are aware of our moods, we can do a couple of things. A, we can note when they're there and when they pass, so we know when it's safe to make decisions. If I'm in a place of real depression, real anger, or real fear, that all I see, all my thoughts are fear-driven, or all my thoughts are right now just, you know, disappointed with people, that's a good sign. Maybe I shouldn't right now make a career-altering decision. It's really important to notice what level of energy, whether the mind is truly expansive or really tight, what mood we're in. So now we've covered being aware of the breath and the body, what's going on in the body to support every action, how the body is speaking, it's our emotions to us, our likes and dislikes from experience. Third, what mood we're in. And fourth, the final thing to be aware of, is we stand outside of the thoughts and we just notice whether the thoughts are, what kind of thoughts are they? Are they very loud? Are my thoughts extremely loud? Am I shouting at myself? Are my thoughts really repetitive? Are they coming up again and again and again? Oops, what about money? What about money? What about money? Oh, fuck them. What about money? What about money? What about money? No, don't worry. What about money? What about, or what about, you know, gotta get a job, gotta get a job, gotta get a job, gotta get a job. If our thoughts are acting like somebody that we would not want to be around.
Hey, by the way, did you think about this in the last minute?
Then that's a clue that we shouldn't trust them. That this is not something that's taking us in a good direction. That this is not something that we should give energy to. That this is something we should maintain as much distance from as we can. If our thoughts are yelling at us. If our thought is something we couldn't imagine somebody really wise saying. If our thoughts are something that we couldn't imagine saying to somebody else in the same situation. If our thoughts are something that if everybody could hear them, we'd be ashamed. Any of these you can use. I often use the, could I imagine somebody really, really helpful and compassionate saying this? And if I can, that means the thought is not helpful. Because everything good in my life that I've accomplished with a compassionate, peaceful, kind mind. I've never accomplished anything worthwhile from anger. I've never accomplished anything worthwhile from a sense of I'm worthless or a thought telling me that everything's going to fall apart unless I follow it. Now you might say, but what about protesting? Isn't that based on anger? In my experience, people who protest, who do really good, engaged social work, aren't in fact inspired by anger. They're inspired by compassion for others to end the suffering that other people experience. And people whose social work is fired up by anger and hatred, these are the people who burn out really quickly and don't sustain really good, worthwhile actions and endeavors in the world. So it's really important to practice this ability to not climb aboard thoughts, to not get sucked away from what's going on in the body and how our feelings are expressing themselves and what mood we're in, so that we can maintain enough of a distance to decide, is this thought something that I want to encourage? Remember, as the old neuroscientists say, neurons that fire together wire together. The thoughts that we think, we are hardwiring into our brain. If I think thoughts that I'm of violence or anger with myself or just constant self-judgment, I'm wiring my mind to think that way in the future. So this is a real choice. Every moment of the day, we can detach from the thought, relax the body, relax the breath, relax the feelings, see if we can wait for moods to pass and relax moods with the breath. And finally then, when we've gotten enough distance from the thoughts, we can decide, okay, this thought has been plaguing me over and over and over again. Maybe I can at least know that it's not my friend, that it's not something that has my best interests at heart. And I can wait for a thought that's much less repetitive and angry to come along and follow that. So that's mindfulness in a nutshell. All four. It in 30.